This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED. Welcome back to the EMDocs.net podcast. Today, I'm here with Jess Pelletier. Jess, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Britt. Thanks for having me on EMDocs again today. It's great to be back. I have a really interesting case that I'm looking forward to sharing with you. So I had a 20-year-old Caucasian male with only a history of ADHD who came in after presenting to a small community ED for severe pain and weakness in both of his thighs and inability to walk independently that started when he woke up that morning. He'd been in his normal state of health the day before and reported spending the whole day on the couch. But 2 days before ED presentation, he had been welding for a number of hours in 105 degree Fahrenheit heat. Nothing like this had ever happened to him before, and he denied weakness of his upper extremities, paresthesias, vision changes, trouble swallowing or speaking, or drug or alcohol use. On our exam, the patient's cranial nerves 2 through 12 were intact, and he had 5 out of 5 strength in the bilateral upper extremities. However, his lower extremity strength, while 2 out of 5 distal to the knees, was only 2 out of 5 when he tried to flex his thighs. He had no sensory deficits or ataxia on finger-to-nose testing. The patient wouldn't get up to walk because he was afraid of falling, and his parents showed us a video of him walking into the outside hospital ED, where he could barely lift his thighs to take a step, and his parents had to support both of his arms.
Yeah, definitely not a presentation we see very often in the ED, that young male patient with legitimate weakness. What were you thinking at this point?
So our initial differential for causes of sudden onset bilateral lower extremity weakness included things like Guillain-Barré syndrome, disc herniation or spinal epidural abscess leading to cauda equina or conus medullaris syndrome, transverse myelitis, or rhabdomyolysis. But none of these diagnoses completely fit his clinical picture. He should have theoretically had preceding diarrhea or other flu-like illness symptoms with Guillain-Barré. We would expect some degree of back pain or trauma with a central disc herniation or an epidural abscess. Plus, he had no fevers or risk factors like IV drug use. Involvement of only the proximal muscles didn't really fit with central neurologic etiologies, and it would be really odd for rhabdomyolysis to cause focal weakness of the proximal thigh muscles rather than generalized weakness. There was a bit of a delay to identifying his outside ED records, but on review, these revealed totally normal CT scans of the cervical, thoracic, and lumbar spine, CBC, CMP, CK, and lactate levels, with the exception of a potassium level of 2.0 milliequivalents per liter. The patient had received 40 milliequivalents of oral potassium chloride prior to transfer. On repeat in RED, the potassium was 2.6 milliequivalents per liter, and the rest of his labs, including TSH, were totally normal. Another 40 milliequivalent oral dose of potassium chloride was given, and neurology and the hospitalist saw the patient and correctly identified the diagnosis of hypokalemic periodic paralysis, recommending repletion of potassium to a goal of 4 milliequivalents per liter. Oral repletion was continued until he reached a serum potassium of 4.2 milliequivalents per liter 2 days later, and his weakness completely resolved. He was actually discharged to follow up with neuromuscular neurology and genetics, and as of my last chart review, this patient was doing well.
Great case. You had a thorough evaluation and differential and made the diagnosis. But Jess, I'm trying to brush off some cobwebs here. What exactly is hypokalemic periodic paralysis?
Well, Britt, this is an odd duck of a diagnosis that I had never seen in real life, and that's why I wanted to talk about it with you today. So hypokalemic periodic paralysis, or HPP, is a form of primary periodic paralysis, a class of diseases typically caused by mutations that impact calcium, potassium, or sodium muscle ion channels. There are three main types, including HPP, but also hyperkalemic periodic paralysis, and something called Anderson-Towle syndrome, which I had never heard of before. These are all caused by different genetic defects that lead to channelopathies. The epidemiology, pathophysiology, clinical presentation, and treatment strategies differ for each one. We'll only discuss HPP today.
I really didn't know that there were variants of periodic paralysis. I'm also glad that you shortened this to HPP. So much easier to say. Jess, how common is this disease?
So this is really rare, Britt, with an incidence of 1 per 100,000 people. There are two main subtypes, which include thyrotoxic HPP and familial. The thyrotoxic form is more common than familial HPP and only occurs in the setting of active hyperthyroidism. It's more common in patients of Asian descent for unknown reasons and has a 9-to-1 male predominance. Caucasians with thyrotoxic HPP often won't show any signs or symptoms of thyrotoxicosis, and the reason for this is unclear. Familial HPP is an autosomal dominant disorder with incomplete penetrance and more commonly presents in males than in females.
So HPP can be inherited or it can be associated with hyperthyroidism. What's the underlying pathophysiology?
Well, thyrotoxic HPP is caused by increased sodium-potassium ATPase pump activity that occurs in the setting of hyperthyroidism, whereas familial HPP is caused by mutations in one of two genes that impact skeletal muscle calcium or sodium channels. The patient in our case was actually undergoing genetic testing for these two channelopathies as of my last chart check. Both channelopathies lead to paradoxical depolarization and failure of excitation of muscle fibers in the setting of low extracellular potassium. It's important to note that HPP only impacts skeletal muscles, not smooth or cardiac, so there shouldn't be any symptoms that involve other systems, unlike Anderson-Towle syndrome, which can actually affect all muscle types.
That is one of the key points here. If you see a patient with flaccid paralysis that's associated with cardiac, GI, or respiratory symptoms, it probably isn't HPP. How do these patients present? What should we be looking for?
Well, the first episode usually happens before age 20, but can occur up to age 35. HPP patients usually present with focal or generalized paralysis that can last anywhere from hours to days in the setting of a trigger. The physical location of weakness can vary from exam to exam, and sometimes that can raise concern for functional weakness, so we have to be careful not to discount patients' complaints. Typical triggers for familial HPP episodes include rest after heavy exercise, emotional stress, physical stressors like fasting, pregnancy, cold weather, alcohol, beta-adrenergic agonists, medications that cause hypokalemia, glucocorticoids, states of high insulin levels like meals rich in carbohydrates, and high sodium intake. HPP episodes happen less frequently after age 40. One thing I didn't know, Britt, is that permanent muscular weakness can occur, and there's no way of predicting which patients with HPP will develop this. There's also no association between the number or severity of attacks and the potential for permanence of symptoms. If permanent weakness happens, it usually affects the proximal lower extremities in older patients and develops late in the disease course.
I had no idea that HPP could cause permanent weakness. That term periodic, it's in the name, just a slight misnomer. Jess, can we make this diagnosis in the ED?
Well, it's hard to exclude all differentials in the ED, but I think we actually can make this diagnosis, Britt. We are going to include the diagnostic criteria for HPP in the show notes, and not all diagnostic criteria are easy to rule out right away, but we have to identify characteristic clinical features like focal or generalized weakness in the setting of a typical trigger, combined with hypokalemia at the time of the attack. As we discussed before, the differential for HPP is very broad, so we need to make sure this patient isn't suffering from GBS, spinal cord pathology, and myasthenia gravis. Alternative causes of the presentation have to be excluded based on our history, physical exam, and ED diagnostic workup. The HPP patient on physical exam should have flaccid paralysis with little to no involvement of bulbar or respiratory muscles. The lab workup should include a BMP and a magnesium to rule out electrolyte derangements or renal dysfunction that could contribute to weakness, and we should be ordering a TSH to assess for thyroid dysfunction. If the TSH and potassium levels are low, this suggests a diagnosis of thyrotoxic HPP. The need for imaging is pretty debatable in the setting of patients who present with classic HPP with low serum potassium, but central etiologies for weakness, such as stroke, should cause spastic, not flaccid paralysis. The exception here would be spinal shock or acute stroke, but patients with spinal shock should theoretically have a history of trauma, and a patient with acute stroke might have other complaints besides weakness, and they'll have risk factors for stroke. Weakness from an acute stroke is hypotonic, with the extreme being flaccid, and the spasticity develops over time.
Like Jess said, we'll have a table with the full diagnostic criteria in the show notes. They're not too extensive, but there are some specifics. They basically take into account the clinical presentation with weakness, a low potassium level, involvement of other family members, there's some sort of trigger, and then you also have to exclude other conditions that might cause hypokalemia. Based on this patient's presentation and the potassium, it sure looks like this was HPP. Jess, how do we manage acute attacks in the ED setting?
Well, Britt, the acute management of HPP involves the administration of oral or IV potassium. We don't need to give IV potassium unless the patient just can't tolerate PO. The recommended PO dose is 0.2 to 0.4 milliequivalents per kilogram every 30 minutes, with a maximum dose of 200 to 250 milliequivalents per day, and we will include that in the show notes. If we need to give IV administration, then the patient should receive continuous cardiac monitoring and get a maximum of 20 milliequivalents per hour and a maximum dose of 200 milliequivalents per day of potassium. It should be noted that normal saline and dextrose-containing diluents need to be avoided, since both salt and carbohydrates are triggers for HPP and the patient's symptoms might worsen. Neurology should be consulted during the patient's ED visit, if possible. And if they're not available, then the patient should be discharged once the potassium has been fully repleted and their weakness is resolved. A referral needs to be placed to neuromuscular neurology and genetics for further testing with EMG, as well as identification of those typical mutations we talked about earlier. We should be sending these patients with a prescription for daily oral potassium, like I mentioned, but also consideration for magnesium supplementation to promote retention of potassium by the kidneys. Now, neurology may recommend discharging the patient with other agents like acetazolamide, diclofenamide, or potassium-sparing diuretics to prevent attack recurrence. And only diclofenamide is FDA-approved for this indication. I had never heard of this drug before, so this is not something I'm going to be prescribing without a consultant recommending it. Patients need to be counseled to avoid typical triggers and consider engaging in mild exercise like walking at the onset of attacks, because this actually helps reduce episode severity.
You hit all the major points there. The keys are to replete potassium, but don't overshoot. Consult neurology. These patients might be appropriate for discharge if they have resolution of all of their symptoms and their potassium has been repleted, but they do need a prescription for potassium supplementation at discharge, and you also need to ensure that they can follow up. Jess, what are your major take-home points?
Absolutely, Brent. So hypokalemic periodic paralysis is a rare skeletal muscle channelopathy caused by either hyperthyroidism or genetic mutation. The presentation involves flaccid, not spastic paralysis, and this can be focal or generalized, usually showing up in the first 2 decades of life. Episodes are provoked by typical triggers such as rest after heavy exercise, carbohydrate loading, heavy salt intake, physical or emotional stress, alcohol, and some medications. Our ED workup should include excluding alternate causes of symptoms, and the treatment involves restoring normal potassium levels. We need to make sure these patients receive appropriate neuromuscular neurology and genetic referrals, and that we counsel them about lifestyle modifications.
Jess, awesome work. I know I feel a lot more comfortable making this diagnosis and managing these patients. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Britt. And a shout out to Davis Sugar, one of my former co-residents at Virginia Tech Carilion, who helped edit the content of this podcast. Thanks, Davis.
Thanks for joining us on the emdocs.net podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.